We can deal with the challenge of Dr. David Livingstone, the best friend Africa ever had. Isaiah 6 verse 8, also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? Then I said, here am I, Lord, send me. What would Dr. David Livingstone say to us today? Dr. David Livingstone is an example of excellence. His life, his legacy, and his literature continue to speak to us today. The challenge of David Livingstone is most relevant to our times. If Dr. David Livingstone was here today at the Great Commission course at Livingstone House, what would he say to us? We do not need to guess. We have his writings, we have his published statements available. We can know exactly what David Livingstone would say to us today. It is what he said to the people of his own time. The salvation of men ought to be the chief desire and aim of every Christian. All men have the right to hear God's word. No nation ought to hoard the gospel like a miser. Can the love of Christ not carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the trader? If you have men who will come only if they know there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all. We must be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified, that holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. We still have a debt of gratitude to Jesus, and there is no greater privilege on earth than, after having our own chains broken off, to go forth and proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of prison to them that are bound. Dr. David Livingstone was inspired by an optimistic view of the future. Like most of the missionaries of the 19th century missionary movement, Livingstone held to the eschatology of victory. Discoveries and inventions are cumulative, filling earth with the glory of the Lord. All nations will sing his glory and bow before him. Our work and its fruits are cumulative. We work towards a new state of things. Future missionaries will be rewarded by conversions for every sermon. We are their pioneers and helpers. Let them not forget the watchmen of the night, who worked when all was gloom and no evidence of success in the way of conversions cheers our path. They will doubtless have more light than we. But we serve our master earnestly, and we proclaim the same gospel they will do. A quiet audience today, he wrote in his journal. The seed is being sown, the least of all seeds now, but it will grow into a mighty tree. It is as if it were a small stone cut out of a mountain, but it will fill the whole earth. We work for a glorious future, which we are not destined to see. The golden age, which has not yet been, but which will be. We are only morning stars shining in the dark, but the glorious morn will break, the good time coming yet. The dominion has been given by the power of commerce and population unto the people of the saints of the Most High. This is an everlasting kingdom, a little stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which will cover the whole earth. For this time we work. By different agencies, the great ruler is bringing all things into a focus. Jesus is gathering all things together to himself, and he is daily becoming more and more the center of the world's hopes and of the world's fears. When David Livingstone began his work in Africa, there were less than 5 million people in Africa that would have called themselves Christians, most of those up in Abyssinia, what today is Ethiopia and Egypt. Today there are over 500 million people in Africa who claim to be Christians. This includes, according to Operation World, 150 million Protestants, 50 million Anglicans, 140 million Charismatics, 60 million Pentecostals, and 100 million Independents. David Livingstone plowed in stony ground. He sowed the gospel seed that has produced this great harvest. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nation shall worship before you. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. The life and legacy of David Livingstone changed my life. As a new Christian, converted in 1977, I imbibed many of the presuppositions and tendencies of churches in the 70s, just coming out of the hippie Jesus People Revolution movement. I read Late Great Planet Earth, Satan is Alive on Planet Earth, There's a New World Coming, watched Like a Thief in the Night, and all the other date-setting, end-times, rapture fever publications. I was saved, I loved the Lord, I was enthusiastically involved in evangelism, but my understanding of biblical doctrine was actually quite shallow. I imbibed the prevailing prejudice against Calvinism and was convinced that we were living in the last days. Therefore, I could not at the time consider marriage or children. There was not enough time. The Lord was coming back before the end of the year. I couldn't allow myself to be distracted by worldly matters like family and raising children. I need to devote my last few days on earth to snatching souls from the fire. The rapture was coming surely before the end of that year. I was completely closed to the idea of theological training. What's the point? The Lord will have come before I finish my studies. Better to stay in the field winning souls in his last few days remaining. Then I read The Puritan Hope, Revival and Interpretation Prophecy by Ian Murray, published by Fan of Truth, a producer of spectacularly good publications. This book informed me that all of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century missionary movement were Calvinists and post-millennial. I had no idea what post-millennialism was, but when I read that the father of modern missions, William Carey, and the best friend I've ever had, Dr. David Livingstone, that they were both reformed and post-millennial, I determined to read up on these matters. Earlier I'd read a thin, modern biography on David Livingstone, but it didn't seem too extraordinary, because like most modern books, it had been sanitized. All controversial, politically incorrect details had been omitted. The modern, censored version of Livingstone's life did not mention the ravages of the Islamic slave trade, which David Livingstone confronted, documented, and fought against. It left out his Calvinist convictions and a post-millennial eschatology victory. The modern biographies left out the fact that David Livingstone came to Africa in 1841 with a six-barreled revolver and a double-barreled rifle, very advanced for 1841. His violent confrontations with Islamic slave traders and bold initiatives to set thousands of captives free was also deemed too controversial to include in modern, sanitized, abridged versions of Livingstone's life, because you don't want to interfere with people's safe spaces. However, I've always been something of a bookworm and a love for history, and so finding most of the books available in the average bookshop today to be quite shallow and predictable, I've developed a preference for second-hand bookshops, scouring through them, looking for rare old first editions of these missionaries and these pioneers. And Emma helped me with one more. Very appreciated. I was reading Livingstone's missionary travels as I was following in much of his footsteps in Cape Province of Mozambique in the Zambezi Valley of 1989. And this is when I and the medical team that I was leading was captured by Russian forces, imprisoned by SNASH in the security prison in Mashava, Maputo. What I learned from the writings and from the exemplary life and extraordinary legacy of Dr. David Livingstone transformed my life and my ministry. What did I learn from Dr. David Livingstone? I learned from David Livingstone the importance of discipline. He was disciplined in reading and he was disciplined in exercise. He was self-controlled. David Livingstone abstained from alcohol for life. He was temperate. He was duty-oriented. He was hard-working. Livingstone's work ethic is a rebuke to us all. From age 10, he worked 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, walking an average of 34 kilometers a day, much of this in a crawling or stooping position, amongst or under the machinery or bounced over. And the only holidays they got was Christmas and Easter. I mean, that was it. Sundays, 6 days a week worth. There were no other holidays at that stage, not in the 1820s and 1830s. Imagine the tremendous physical training this was for later transcontinental expeditions throughout Africa. He walked this 34 kilometers a day in the steam, heat, and humidity considered essential for the production of thread. David used his first week's wages to purchase a book on Latin. I mean, what did you spend your first week's wages on? I remember at age 17, my first week's wages, well, first month's wages actually, I bought a suit a black briefcase and a black umbrella. David Livingston, at age 10, bought rudiments of Latin. Age 10. Less than 10% of the children who worked in the cotton mills ever learned to read and write. David not only learned to read and write, he taught himself Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. Each night after work, he would attend a night school from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Then at home, he would study, often until midnight, and each morning began at 5:30, the bell would ring, and his work day began at 6 a.m. Before I go off this picture, let me relate a story which David Livingston never mentioned in his life, but we have it from his father. Now, what happened was, David, at age 9, he wasn't working in the mill yet, was reading a book on the banks of this river by the cotton mill, and he was suddenly alerted by the scream of a little girl. This little girl was having an adventure with her baby brother in a boat and had lost the oars, and the boat was being dragged by the current into the path of the cotton wheel, which would surely crush the boat and kill both of them in minutes. He didn't hesitate, he plunged into the icy river. He saved both the girl and the little baby brother, brought them to shore, brought them back to the parents, and never said a word about the rest of his life. However, the children's parents came over to thank David Livingston's parents, and later when Livingston applied to the London Missionary Society, his father related the story in the testimonial that he was asked to give for his son, and that stayed in the attic records of London Missionary Society, otherwise we wouldn't even know about it. When he was studying medicine and theology, David would walk from Blantyre to Glasgow, refusing every offer of a ride on a horse cart passing by. People were very friendly, they were offering help, but he preferred the 4-hour walk, often in the snow, remember, Scotland, in order to strengthen his muscles for his chosen career and missions. After having built up a strong constitution in his childhood, he didn't want to now lose it while he studied. Livingston never accepted charity, although brought up in the poorest of circumstances, where the family of 7, 2 parents and 5 children, were forced to live in a single room, this room, 10 foot by 14 feet, without any electricity or plumbing, no running water. He worked, and he saved up to put himself through both medical school and theological college. David was the first worker from the cotton mills to receive a university education, and nobody gave it to him. I've read biographies in Livingston written by idiots who know nothing, but David Livingston received a bursary to study at the college in Glasgow. There were no bursaries in the 19th century. Where do these people get this from? Just because we've got helpless imbeciles today who can't do anything unless somebody gives it to them for free, they assume that that's the way it always was. No. David Livingston did not get a bursary. Nobody got a bursary. There was no such thing. He earned it. He passed it with high honours. He received his doctorate from the Royal Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons, November 1840. He was ordained as a Congregational Minister, 20 November 1840. Against all odds, he achieved far more than anyone else would have thought humanly possible for somebody born into such a poverty-stricken and disadvantaged background. This is where he was brought up. There were 24 families crammed into this tenement building, each one having only a single room. These round sections are where the circular staircase were. His family were at the top floor, on one end, on the third floor. This pump here is the only source of water for those 24 homes. And he and his brother would have gone up and down the staircase many a time, carrying every drop of water they need for washing, cleaning, cooking. He did not wait for someone else to open up Africa. He didn't wait for somebody to invent a four-wheel drive vehicle. He didn't wait for people to build the roads and the bridges. He drew the first maps of the Zambezi River. He did not have an attitude of entitlement. David Livingston had a Protestant work ethic. Now, just for amusement, these are some maps of Africa that were out there over the years. Talk about the dark continent. Talk about confusion. I mean, this is embarrassing. These are what scientists and geographers drew of the maps of Africa. It's like, do you see where the mountains of the moon are? Like, roughly where some of you come from in the France are. And that's why, if you go to the Kruger National Park today, they will tell you there's the Nile crocodile. Has this crocodile got anything to do with the Nile? No, of course not. It's that they assumed that the Limpopo and so on were the part of the Nile River. the cars knew so little about Africa, they assumed that the crocodiles we had in South Africa came from the Nile, in other words, from Egypt. And that's what their maps were telling you, even the 16th century. The Nile goes all the way down to us, basically. And really bad, seriously bad. In the days of David Livingstone, when he came in 1840, this was the map of Africa. Big open spaces, which geographers and scientists of the time assumed was one big desert. They all assumed the hinterland of Africa was a massive desert. David Livingstone filled in the maps, and showed, no, no, no. The hinterland of Africa is full of lakes and rivers and plateaus and mountains and far more complex than anyone around the world had ever imagined. And this is his map of his trans-Africa journey of 1853 to 1856. This, you can see a copy of it, which was in the first edition of his missionary travels, and it's hanging up in our Christianity bookshop next door. He drew this from the ground, without drones, without GPS systems, with very simple compass, sextant, observing the stars, boiling the water in the, I should say, having his thermometer in the water as it boiled to work out the exact temperature of the water boiler, to work out the altitude. And at one point, David Livingstone was traveling down the Zambezi River, and he noticed this phenomenal cloud of mist and spray in distance. What is that? Local people said, Musi Oyetanya, the smoke that thunders. What makes the smoke thunder? Spirits. Holy, evil spirits. Well, David Livingstone borrowed a canoe and bravely went towards. He realized there must be some kind of waterfall or rapids here. It must be unbelievably big because he'd never seen anything that big before. And he bravely went to Livingstone Island, which has beached this canoe on it. It's called Livingstone Island to this day. And he crawled to the edge and looked out and gazed upon a sight which said, angels at creation must have gazed at such spectacles and sight. Now, these two men standing there with their arrows, that's total imagination. There was no such people there. It's just, again, ignorant artists and authors putting that sort of thing in. David Livingstone had nobody volunteering to come with him to this. And I've heard people say, that's rubbish. This is kind of discovered. Victoria Falls. Everybody knew Victoria Falls. And, well, maybe not. Because nobody knew what was there. David Livingstone was the first one to name it, identify it, make it known to the world, and measure it. And this is his map. Notice, 150 paces, 400 feet deep. Victoria Falls is 1,860 yards wide and 310 feet deep. This is from his journal, the actual first sketching, 150 paces since on. Now, you know, we measure it today, we can't improve in the measurements. He's dead right. It is 1,860 yards wide, it says 310 feet deep. He let a weighted ball, lead weights on string, measured it out to the bottom, measured it out 310 feet. How he worked out the measurements of this, extraordinary. He did better than that. These are sketches from his first edition, Livingstone's Travels, which you will never get in these modern books. But there is no elevation from which he could get this view. He positioned himself to give the people an understanding of the deep ravines and so on. He put himself in a position that without helicopters and drones we couldn't do today. Well, we could do it today with those things, but he did that before us. And he's accurate. That is what Victoria Falls is. And he's got it right. This is also from his first edition of Missionary Travels. And this, on the ground, he worked this out. He didn't have a drone. He didn't have a GPS.
Did he draw all of these?
Yes, these are sketches. This is in his Missionary Travels books. Phenomenal. I mean, super accurate. Phenomenally accurate. Now, on his second missionary journey, he took with him Thomas Baines, whose artwork you see, original artwork you saw in the castle when he visited on Saturday last week. So this is interesting because notice the huge herds of buffalo, even when Thomas Baines went there, which was many years later. What David Livingstone said is in those 26 years of walking across Africa, he never saw a greater concentration of one glove, a greater paradise of one glove than around Victoria Falls, which confirms my suspicions that perhaps David Livingstone was the first person to actually see the falls. Because nobody was hunting there, even though it was rich with game. The game knew this is a good place to be because the people were too scared to come there because of the superstitious witchcraft adherence and the terror of something that the people didn't understand. The roar of the waterfall and so on. So what Livingstone did, it's not just that he's the first one to have measured it and made it known. He might have even been the first person to see it. So, very, very interesting. Victoria Falls is one of the seven natural wonders of the world. And it's forever associated with David Livingstone, who first described it, mapped it, made it known to the world. And what an incredible, phenomenal, millions of liters of water pouring over there every few minutes in the rainy season. Calvin and I have been there during the rainy season, and we couldn't have got more wet if we jumped in the river. The spray, it's like nothing on earth to prepare for that. That's right. Yes. It did indeed. Yeah. No, it's true. To achieve what he did, Livingstone was decisive, he was goal-oriented, he was inflexible. Reformed theology put doctrinal steel in his backbone. I mean, tough, hard theology makes tough, hard people. And, you know, you think, Four Trekkers, Covenanters, Puritans, Pilgrims, the Roundheads of Cromwell, the Dutch fighters for freedom under William of Orange. This thing, soft theology makes soft, weak people. Hard theology makes tough people. And David Livingstone was a man of integrity. He was a man of his word. He meant what he said, and he said what he meant. He walked many thousands of miles across difficult and dangerous terrain to return his porters to the village. Now, on his first missionary journey, it took him about 2 years to walk from Cape Town up through Botswana, what today is Zimbabwe and Zambia, across all of Angola to the port of Luanda, which is the capital of Angola, Portuguese West Africa at the time. Now, when he got there, the English ship, the Forerunner, was waiting. It could take him home. He was already famous. There was people just extraordinarily amazed at what he had achieved. And he could have gone the boat and he could have been home in a few weeks. But he was concerned that his porters get safely back to the village, and they didn't know the direction finding stars and all the things that he had studied, and so he knew he needed, and also he was concerned that he had to protect them from all the many different tribes that couldn't slay them. Even the Portuguese, who were the only country in Europe still doing the slave trade in the 1850s, because all the other countries in Europe had abandoned slave trade back in 1815 at the Treaty of the Council of Vienna after the Battle of Waterloo and the end of the French Napoleonic Wars. But Portugal still did slavery. And so David Livingstone took another 2 years to walk his porters back to their villages, and then to walk all the way across to Mozambique and to the mouth of the Zambezi River, followed Zambezi all the way into the Indian Ocean, because he was too honourable to have his men find their own way back home. Now, how's that for being a man of your word? David Livingstone understood the power of prayer. He had Holy Spirit fire in his heart, soul, and mind. He prayed and he sang the Psalms daily. He had a great love for God's creation, for nature, and for wildlife. And his books are filled with intricate sketches and fascinating details of animals and vegetation previously unknown to the wide Western world. For example, the eland, the largest antelope or buck in the world. They weigh like a ton. The hippopotamus, which most people knew virtually nothing about. Here, the water bugs. And the baobab tree, of which you could make a lot of things from, including rope and sandals. The different implements people used, both for farming and the different types of body piercing, tattoos, bangles around the ankles, and different tattooing and body piercing that they use in the faces. The different types of hairstyles and beards. And the musical instruments people played, like here in Angola, and like, would you say, this part of the marimba type of class. And then the different rituals people observed, like the dances of the new moon, and how the bushmen collected water and ostrich eggs that were empty and used tufts of grass to fill the hole at the top. You see how they're putting tufts of grass in there, and they're keeping them in nets, and then they bury them in the sand so that when they're crossing someplace that they've got water available. He observed everything. His details in his books on flora and fauna and God's creation. And imagine walking across in Africa before the big game hunters and the roads and the railways, and just seeing these massive herds and these phenomenal amounts of animals and the migrations. And what David Livingstone saw and what he described and what he sketched is just absolutely phenomenal. And yes, some of the animals are pretty dangerous, some are fascinating, and some very silent. You may not see the leopard, but the leopard will see you. The fastest animals in the world, the largest animals in the world, and he's one of the missionaries who reported back there is snow on the mountaintops on the equator in Africa. And this made so many people in Africa, just like in Europe, say, you know, these missionaries are all liars. I mean, obviously there can't be snow in Africa. How on earth could there be snow at the equator? Are they out of their minds? Everyone knows this is impossible. And the scientists dismissed them as fakes and frauds and hoaxes, you know, like fake news. Until the invention of photography, the people in Europe did not believe that there was snow at the equator. In fact, there's one poor German missionary who came to Kenya and Tanzania who basically lost all his support when he reported on seeing snow at the equator, because people discounted him. Well, he's obviously a liar. I mean, there's no way it's possible, so we know it's not true, therefore he must be lying, right? But no, they were actually telling the truth. There is snow at the equator, even in summer. It's 5,890 meters high. And yes, there's always snow at the equator.
Even in the
mountains of the moon. So you can even see snow in the Congo.
There is, but
it's
very far from.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Congo, we think of the hottest place on earth, and yet even there you can get snow.
Yeah, there is snow. Yeah. I don't know if it's other.
Now you can say that to many people, and they won't believe you, because most people, but there can't be snow in the Congo. No, I believe you, but I'm just saying, many will not. Many will not. David Livingstone was inspired by a post-millennial eschatology of victory. He had a kingdom vision. David Livingstone understood the greatness of the Great Commission. He worked to comprehensively fulfill the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit. As a medical doctor, he ministered to the body. He healed bodies all over Africa. As a teacher, he ministered to the mind. And as a minister of the gospel, he ministered to the spirit. Wherever he went, he used his medical knowledge and training, and his breadth of reading and learning, and his deep faith and knowledge of the Holy Scriptures to enrich and empower the people of Africa. And let me mention something else here that most people may not be aware of. Do you know that David Livingstone, as far as I can tell, didn't seem to use an interpreter? He seems to have acquired the languages. He preached in Tswana. He preached in Tshewa. He preached in Bemba. He preached in Swahili. How did he acquire all these languages? Well, he's very observant. He must have had a gift for this, because he'd go to a village and he'd have his notebook and he'd be observing and he'd be listening and he might ask questions and maybe using the language of the previous tribe, and to the point where he'd have the conference stand up and he would preach the gospel in their language. That is just phenomenal. I don't know anyone who can do that. It's, yeah, we have all kinds, you know, we can get dictionaries and language course apparatus that will help us and people who can train us, and we struggle. I mean, Hebrew and Greek and Latin have been some of the hardest subjects I've had to study. I mean, I don't have a gift of languages. I struggled with them. But David Livingstone, William Carey seem to have just had this gift of tongues. I mean, extraordinary. They would master multiple languages. William Carey translated the whole Bible into 6 languages, New Testaments and Gospels into another 29. That's 35 languages, aside from English, that William Carey mastered enough to translate the scripture into. That's just incredible. Do you know anyone on the planet who could say they've mastered 35 languages? Enough to translate the scriptures into it? This is the flyleaf, if I can use that word, for the missionary travels and researchers in South Africa. Now, of course, in those days, there wasn't a country called South Africa. South Africa just meant like the South of Africa, like this South America. And so don't get confused. He's talking about going all the way to Angola, Mozambique, and so on and there. But still, at that stage, that was all called South Africa. And why does he have a tsetse fly here? He said the tsetse fly is the biggest hindrance to travel in Africa because it'll kill horses. And therefore, if you see any pictures of David Livingston riding a horse in the hinterland of Africa, that's total rubbish. It's complete imagination. No horse could survive up in these territories because of the tsetse fly. When I was doing my bushcraft training, I mean, one of the great things about being brought up in Rhodesia is every year you'd have bushcraft training. You'd go for a week of survival in the bush in a game reserve with a game ranger training in tracking, anti-tracking, survival, and so on. And I remember one of our people getting stung by a tsetse fly. Not fun. And it was many years before I got stung by a tsetse fly and understood what pain that can cause. It came straight through my jeans, into my knee, and it didn't matter how much cortisone cream I put on multiple times a day, it stung like anything. It was unbelievable. And the game ranger said, praise God for the tsetse fly. Without the tsetse fly, we wouldn't have game reserves. All the game reserves, Wanky, Kruger Park, Tosha, they're all placed where tsetse flies reign, and therefore stock farmers can't farm, you can't have cattle there, you can't have horses, it's useless for most farmers, therefore that's the area that we get as the game reserve. So he says, praise God for the tsetse fly. They are who God has used to protect whole areas so that you can have game reserves. The mosquito. David Livingstone is the first person that we can tell who identified mosquitoes as the cause of malaria. The name malaria, if you know your Latin, mal, bad, area, air, malaria, bad air. What causes a malaria? Bad air, swamp fever. It's because the roof is too low. You must have high roofs. And so I was brought up in colonial Rhodesia where all the roofs are very high, you know, double your height, would be even your bedrooms. All roofs are high because just to allow the bad air to rise. And so the whole medical scientific fraternity was convinced and in consensus that swamp fever is what causes malaria, and therefore malaria, the best treatment is high air, high ceilings and open windows, and these louvered things and so on. David Livingstone was the first person. He was 20-something years ahead of the medical fraternity, saying, actually, mosquitoes cause malaria. And they're like, what do you think? Insects cause malaria? Seriously? I mean, how did you get this nonsense from? And then Livingstone went further. He says, and it's not just mosquitoes that cause malaria. It's the female mosquitoes, and it's the pregnant female mosquitoes. And they only lay their eggs between about midnight and 5 in the morning. So if you under your mosquito net roughly from 11 at night to 6 in the morning, you won't get malaria. You might get bitten by a mosquito, but you won't get malaria. And for a couple of decades, the scientists were thinking, you know, he's gone bossy. He just doesn't understand. But David Livingstone was spot on. He's dead right. Now we know he is right. Only the female pregnant mosquitoes cause malaria in the midnight hours. Now look at this. I remember these being brought up in Rhodesia. Livingstone's Rouser. So quinine, this is anti-malarial medicine, was called Livingstone's Rouser to rouse you from malaria. David Livingstone was the man who identified quinine as the cure for malaria. Now what's quinine? Quinine comes from a bush grown in Brazil. When David Livingstone came out from Britain, they would often follow the trade winds close to South America and then swoop down with trade winds across South Atlantic to get into Cape Town. But in a storm, their foremast was split and they had to put into Rio de Janeiro in order to get in the forest nice new foremast that they could fashion. While they were doing this, he was doing evangelism in the waterfront and almost got beat up by a bunch of drunken sailors and ministered in a hospital. But he also, as he loved to do, went into the forest and he explored and he took cuttings of different branches and trees and catalogued and different stones and observed all kinds of natural phenomena. Later on, he experimented with everything when coming across malaria, and he found the quinine, the leaves from the quinine bush, that was the cure for malaria. And that's how he stayed in the field 26 years at a time when the average missionary's life expectancy gap was 2 years. He beat the odds. He was a scientist. David Livingstone teaches that actions speak louder than words. He was described as a man of resolute courage. Fire, water, stone wall would not stop Livingstone in the fulfillment of any recognized duty. Indeed, he did not let swamps stop him. He did not let rivers stop him. He did not let deserts or mountains prevent him from opening up Africa for the gospel. David Livingstone was determined to make a difference. The Great Commission was his supreme ambition. Christ's last command was his first concern. He wrote, "I hope to be permitted to work as long as I live beyond other men's line of things and plant the seed of the gospel where others have not planted. I am a missionary, heart and soul." God had an only son, and he was a missionary and a physician. A poor, poor imitation of him I am or wish to be. In his service I hope to live, in it I wish to die. I shall open up a path to the interior, or I will perish. May God bless us and make us blessings even unto death. Shame upon us missionaries if we're to be outdone by slave trades. I mean, if the slave trades can get there, why can't we? Battling rains, chronic discomfort, rust, mildew and rot. Totally drenched and fatigued, laid low by fever countless times, David Livingstone continued to persevere across the continent. Trials tested the tenacity of the travel-weary team. Often Livingstone endured excessive and unnecessary suffering and deprivation, hacking his way through dense jungle on foot because the lack of funds prevented him from the luxury of a canoe. I wouldn't have thought a canoe is a luxury when you're mapping the Zambezi River. These privations, I beg you to observe, are not sacrifices. I think that word, sacrifice, ought never to be mentioned in reference to anything that we can do for him. Though he was rich, yet for our sakes, he became poor. The challenge of David Livingstone rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. David Livingstone emphasized that sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. It's not so much what we say, but what we do. We need to put feet to our faith. Livingstone alerted the world to the cancerous sore of the Islamic slave trade. It was missionary explorer David Livingstone whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light. His missionary travels and narratives of an expedition to the Zambezi, that's his second book, exposed the horrors of the slave trade. Two of the women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their thongs. One woman had her infant's brains knocked out because she could not carry her load and the baby. A man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. Those taken out of the country are but a very small section of the sufferers. We never realized the atrocious nature of the traffic until we saw it at its fountainhead. There Satan truly has a seat. Besides those actually captured, thousands are killed and die of wounds and famine. Driven from the villages by the internecine war waged for slaves, with their own clansmen and neighbors, slain by the lust of gain, which is stimulated, be it remembered always, by the slave purchases of Cuba and elsewhere. David Livingstone taught that you cannot be neutral in the battlefields of life. He had the courage to confront evil. His fearless faith fought the good fight of faith, and he set many thousands of captives free. Submit to God, resist the devil, he will flee from you. David Livingstone is an example of extraordinary patience and perseverance. He overcame every obstacle walking across the continent of Africa. He walked from Delgo Bay, that's present-day Port Elizabeth, all the way up through Kraaifontein, which he said is the prettiest town in Africa, where he stayed in the Andrew Murray family's home, through to Kuruman in what is today Northern Cape. He walked across what is today Botswana and all the way back across the Cape Colony to Cape Town to place his family on a ship to return to Britain. He then walked from Cape Town across the whole of the Cape Province through what is today Botswana, Zambia and Angola through to the port of Luanda. This is the cross section. You also get this in the first edition of Livingston's Travels book, showing the whole way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean, in Mozambique, from Angola to Mozambique, and he describes the different terrain, and he's got the elevations. This is an ideal cross section of the continent of Africa. He walked across what is today Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique to the Indian Ocean. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He came back and explored much of the Zambezi River, the Shiri Valley, and the Rovuma River. He walked across most of what is today Mozambique, Malawi, Tanzania, Zimbabwe. Yet in all these things, we are more than conquerors through Christ Jesus who loved us. On his third great missionary journey, he walked across the whole length of Tanzania, much of Mozambique, Malawi, Zambia, the Congo, Burundi, and finally died on his knees in prayer in the province of Luapula in northern Zambia at age 60. In his 30 years of dedicated missionary service in Africa, he walked from coast to coast across what is today 12 great countries. He walked across a continent which did not yet have roads or bridges or purified water. I shall try to hold myself in readiness to go anywhere, provided it be forwards, he said. David Livingstone teaches us the power of the printed page. If it was books that he read, like Practical Christianity by William Wilberforce, the missionary to Parliament, who pioneered the anti-slavery campaigns that saw it abolished in his lifetime. And it's Practical Christianity which channeled much of his life in dedicated labours to eradicate the slave trade and open up Africa for the gospel. Livingstone wrote Missionary Travels, the Zambezi Expedition, and his journals, which inspired generations of missionaries to dedicate their lives to winning Africa for Christ, including Mary Slessor, who devoted her life to Calabar, present-day Nigeria, and Peter Cameron, who launched the African Inland Mission. If you think David Livingstone was poor, Mary Slessor was poorer. David Livingstone at least had a loving, dedicated father. Mary Slessor didn't even have that. Peter Cameron had returned from Africa in failure after his first mission. However, when he read the inscription on the tomb of David Livingstone, Westminster Abbey, which I've also read, "Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring. They shall hear my voice." Cameron felt rebuked, inspired, and resolved to return to Africa, and then he succeeded in launching the biggest mission in East Africa, African Land Mission. Today in Kenya, African Land Church is like the main church in the country. David Livingstone knew the power of the printed page. He knew the power of public speaking tours. He focused on the universities as strategic for mobilizing reformers and missionaries to fulfill the Great Commission. David Livingstone saw rivers, which others saw as obstacles. He saw them as God's highway to reach Africa for Christ. All communities need access to water. Rivers are strategic arteries which missionaries should utilize to fulfill the Great Commission. That's inspired one of our missionary initiatives of the Congo River Mission to try and reach the 18 million people in the Congo River and Delta tributaries, many of whom cannot be reached any other way than by rivers. We've got a naval captain working on that. He's already been up and down the Congo River and is working on developing that mission. David Livingstone believed in leadership training. His vision was to establish Bible colleges for Africans to be trained as evangelists, teachers, and missionaries to disciple the nations. He was overruled by his mission society, who didn't believe the time was right. And that frustrated him, but it freed him to explore Africa and deal a death blow to Islamic slavery. The life and legacy of David Livingstone has taught me the importance of discipline, exercise, reading, a Christian work ethic, temperance, self-control, self-denial, and to be duty-orientated. His reformed theology has put doctrinal steel in my backbone. When I started out, I was an antinomian, arminian, premill, pre-trib, dispensational, rapture fever character who called himself a New Testament Christian, who on my first mission to Mozambique only took New Testaments because I didn't want to confuse them with the whole Bible. I mean, how bad is that? But become a Bible Christian, whole Bible, not just the New Testament. That was what his kind of reformed theology rebuked in me. He has taught me the importance of being a man of my word, a person of integrity, and most importantly, a man of God's word. The post-millennial eschatology of victory of David Livingstone has inspired me by not working at uncertainty. The Lord who gave us the Great Commission will ensure that it's fulfilled. God has not destined us to defeat. He hasn't predestined his church to defeat. This isn't the culmination of the church age. The bride of Christ is not ready for Christ's return. The church is in a shameful state. We cannot expect the Lord to return until we fulfill the Great Commission. There's a lot of work still to do. His promises and his power are fully sufficient to empower his church to fulfill his Great Commission, making disciples of all nations, including Saudi Arabia and Libya, teaching obedience to all things that he has commanded. David Livingstone's comprehensive vision of fulfilling the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit, has raised the standard of missionary service for all of us. It's a rebuke to religious tourism. Actions speak louder than words. Sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We must put feet to our faith. We must recognize we're in a world war of worldviews. And let me tell you something about this picture. You know where David Livingstone's first mission station was? Kuruman, which I've been to up in Northern Cape. Not too far from Kimberley. He knew geology, he studied everything like that, and he found diamonds, lots of diamonds, big diamonds. Threw them in a bush and never said a word to anyone. Now, you know that later on in his life, the journalist of the century, Henry Morton Stanley, made the scoop of the century by finding David Livingstone, who was hidden somewhere in Africa, looking for the source of the Nile, and nobody knew where he was, and Stanley found him, and as the only two white men, all of Equatorial Africa, from the Zambezi to the Nile, met, Stanley walked deliberately towards him and said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." And Livingstone replied, "Yes." And he lifted his cap slightly, they shook hands, and Stanley said, "I thank God, Doctor, I've been permitted to see you." Livingstone replied, "I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you." Stanley offered Livingstone a whole pile of letters from his family and friends at home, expecting to read them immediately. But he put them to one side and said, "I've waited years for letters. I've been taught patience. I can afford to wait a few miles. Now tell me what's going on in the outside world." Well, he's asked the right person. He's asked the journalist. Stanley gave him an update on the opening of the Suez Canal. You could now travel from the Mediterranean into the Indian Ocean through the Suez Canal. General Grant, now president of the United States of America, the Pacific Railroad had crossed the continent of America, has been completed. Prussia, which today is known as Germany, defeated Denmark and France in war. France meant to be the superpower. The first transatlantic cable has been laid, permitting immediate communication across the Atlantic from North America to Europe. And diamonds have been discovered in South Africa. And Livingstone nods and he says, "I wondered how long it would take them." "What do you mean?" Well, he explains. "Well, why didn't you sell them?" "No, I couldn't do that," said David Livingstone. "We were still trying to evangelize the China. If diamonds had been discovered and all the miners had come in, they would have been destroyed by vice before we'd even been able to lay foundations for the gospel to make progress in life." "Well, why didn't you take the diamonds back to Scotland and sell them there?" "I couldn't do that. They knew where I worked. They would have torn the area apart to find them. These were the most valuable diamonds the world has ever seen. I could not, after having found the pearl of great price, waste my life on diamonds." Now, how's that for keeping goal-orientated, doelgerig, focused, not allowing himself to be distracted? I mean, that's just, like, amazing. What else did I learn from David Livingstone? Islam is a threat to faith and freedom. You cannot be neutral in the battlefields of life. Confront evil. Fight the good fight of faith. Be bold, be brave, be courageous. Be patient and steadfast and persevere. Overcome every obstacle. Go forward in the faith. Never forget the power of the printed page. Invest in books. Invest in your mind. Most people spend more money on their feet than they do on their mind. I mean, think of how much money the average person spends on shoes versus how much money the average person spends on books. Gym for the mind. Invest in books. Invest in your mind. Read. Teach your people to love reading. Readers make leaders. A reading Christian is a growing Christian. And you'll get quite a few books when you finish on Wednesday from us. Do not forget the schools, the colleges, the universities. They are strategic. We must disciple the next generation to be faithful to the Word of God and effective in God's service. Think strategically how we can reach the nations for Christ and make your life count for eternity. In the words of Tripitaka Champanya missionary C.T. Studd, you only have one life and it will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. As William Carey declared, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. So what would David Livingstone say to us today? I beg to direct your attention to Africa. I know that in a few short years I shall be cut off from that country which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. Will you carry out the work I've begun? I leave it with you. Also heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And then I said, here am I, Lord, send my sister. Now that's not actually what Isaiah 6 verse 8 says. That must be the new uninspired contemporary version. 80% of the missionaries in the world today are women. Praise God for them. But where are the men? I mean, it's shocking, it's shameful that so many men are taking the cozy, comfortable, safe jobs back at home in the pastorate and shipping the women off into the mission fields where it's a lot more dangerous. I mean, that's wrong, that's unbalanced. Now, fortunately, in our missions, we have more men than women missionaries, but most missions are overwhelmingly women. Why are the average men missing? Where is the here my Lord send me? So, any questions, comments?
I just wanted to say, I remember when I was in primary school and I was talking to Chapman Fawura, I read and I saw like David Livingstone when he read for the first time and said, the British explorer that discovered Victoria for
Chapman Fawura.
Yeah, they said explorer and I'm learning how to.
But no mention of mission.
Yeah.
I went through school in Rhodesia not knowing David Livingstone was a missionary. I just knew him as an explorer. When I got converted as a I was called to missions. I didn't know a single missionary. And I made that comment. Somebody said, well, you've heard of David Livingstone. I said, is he a missionary? isn't that incredible how they can just like cut out all his motivation? So we have got a sermon and Bible study with multiple languages website called Livingstone Fellowship. In 2013, we started the Livingstone 200 website, which has got links to all kinds of museums and monuments and picture galleries and links to the different books that Livingstone wrote and a lot more. We actually have a Dr. David Livingstone Facebook page. Now, you might see some that David Livingstone, but the one Dr. David Livingstone, that's ours, and you'll get a lot of links and pictures there too. His vision was Africa for Christ. And of course, we're at the Great Commission course now, and we've try to get people out of their comfort zones, and the whole point is to have the idea that obstacles are only there to be overcome. And what we need to do is have the Livingstone vision of being able to say, I can do what I didn't think I can do. I can go out of my comfort zones. I can reach out, learn from history. Yes, love and appreciate wildlife too. And we've got Livingstone Fellowship. You notice this mission headquarters is called Livingstone House, and that's what his boots look like after traveling across the continent and his signature. You will also find a whole lot of tracts on the Livingstone Fellowship website that you can download, over 70 different titles actually. One of the chapters in Sketch of South Pleasant History is about Livingstone. We've added a chapter on victorious Christians who changed the world and the heroes of the faith. There's a whole lot of projects, and in 2013 we sent a missionary team across 12 countries, I think it was a 6 or 7 month mission, where we went as far as Sudan. But we cheated. We drove. This is all too easy to go by. When we complain about the bad roads, let's remind people, we drive where Livingstone walks. And so if somebody comes to you and says, how far is it? Is it walking distance? You can answer, yes. Every man up is walking distance. Livingstone proved that. Yeah. Christmas Day at the time. This is the opening up of the Livingstone Monument on the Rhodesian, or now Zimbabwean, side of Victoria Falls in 1953. That was the 1956, which was the 100th anniversary of him discovering Victoria Falls. So we went there, and we had a Livingstone missionary conference on the 200th anniversary of the birth of David Livingstone. This is the David Livingstone Teacher Training College in Livingstone. This is out at the Victoria Falls. We had national TV. We had at the local TV. We have the mayor of Livingston. This is just one of many churches we ministered in Livingston. We found so many memorials and statues to David Livingston at the Livingston Museum, Livingston School, on both sides, both the Zimbabwe and the Zambian side of Victoria Falls. This statue was put up in 2005. That was on the 150th anniversary of the discovery of Victoria Falls. This was put up in 2011, I think, in Livingston Airport of David Livingston. So they're still putting up monuments to him around Africa. Notice the Bible and so on. And even in 1973, they put up on the centenary of death of David Livingston a stamp in Zambia of Livingston chasing the Arab slave traders out of the country. We've been to where David Livingston died in Zambia, northern Zambia. They've now got where his heart was buried under a tree. They've put this monument up where his heart was buried. If you go to what's the island? Zanzibar. The island of Zanzibar, just off the coast of Tanzania, they've got Christ Church built right over where the slave market used to be. And they've got wood from the tree under which his heart was buried, and a cross over the high altar, which is over where the slave market used to be in the auction block. You can even go to places in Malawi and you'll find a walled-in area, and they say David Livingston rested under this tree as he travelled through. And this is the grave site of Mary Livingston, who died here as part of the Zambezi expedition in Tete province, what today is Mozambique. So we've got a lot of memorials to David Livingston, and we link this all together in our website. This is in Glasgow. In all kinds of areas of Livingston's life, we've been emphasizing up that that's now going on to Reformation 500, another one of our emphasis. Any other questions or comments?
Did he have children?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. One of his oldest son, Robert, died in the American War between the states, fighting on the Union side, was buried in Arlington Cemetery. Yes, another one of his sons died as a medical doctor in Egypt, Oswald. There's quite a story on each of the Livingstons, yes. He had, I think, five children. Robert Moffat. His father-in-law Robert Moffat started the Kuruman mission and was the first to translate the whole Bible into the Tswana language. Well, the first African language to have the whole Bible was the Tswana people, and Robert Moffat, his father-in-law, did that work. Phenomenal missionary family. Robert Moffat put 50 years of his life into Africa. Phenomenal amount of writing, translation. He also translated Pilgrim's Progress into Tswana and things like that. That's the point. I find Livingston and Moffat, in fact, that's why I did the Greatest Century of Missions book, was 19 biographies of 19th century missionaries who are all an inspiration and a rebuke to us, because that's why there was this book that came out recently called Don't Waste Your Life, another one, Do Hard Things. That's what we need. There's a lot of young people today have got to be fed up with just being entertained. I mean, we don't just want to be entertained. We want to get out there and do something. We want to make a difference. And many of these youth groups think that, no, all they can do is dumb everything down and, like, pat you on the head and entertain you. What an insult. I think young people should say, come on, we can sing serious hymns of content. You don't just need to give us mindless ditties. And we can take some good theology and put us to work. Don't just give us religious tourism. We want to get out there and evangelize and change nations. Don't accept this dumbed-down position where everyone expects so little of you. I like this do hard things and don't waste your life emphasis. Excellent. Yes, yes, rebel against the low expectations. It's ridiculous. I mean, when I was 19 years old, we had a gap year. In fact, we had a gap 2 year. It was called national service. We went to the military and we were making decisions which people's lives depended. And, you know, we were expected to grow up very quickly, run with machine guns and all that sort of thing, and be able to really go in dangerous areas and survive. And that's good. And now, I mean, what are they trying to do in the schools? They're trying to dumb everything down and make one a bunch of well, computer junkies and video junkies who couch potatoes. It's just rebellion to say, no way, not for me. And I think we need a new crusade. That's what C.T. Studd started. He called it Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, WEC. He wanted to mobilize missions. And where, how did he choose his mission field? He took a map of Africa, took a line from north to south, east to west, so we're going smack in the middle, which took him into the Congo. And he was baptizing ex-cannibals in the river there with a revolver in his left hand while he's baptizing people with his right and firing to keep the crocodiles away from the baptism. Now, you know, they don't want to put that in missionary biographies today because that's going to upset somebody. So they sort of make it all idyllic, and they don't want to mention the cannibals and don't want to mention the headhunters and the crocodiles and the revolver he slept with under his pillow. And I mean, you know, like, you mustn't hear those things because that might upset your safe space and make you feel uncomfortable. So they've dumbed everything down. So that's why I'm on a campaign to recover our real history without censoring it. And, you know, let's get back to having some tough Christianity instead of a bunch of wimps who want to be entertained.